I am joined in the studio by Thomas Connolly. Now, you might say, who is Thomas Connolly? Thomas Connolly is, of course, the son of Paddy and indeed Eileen Connolly, the late Paddy Avdad, and of course Eileen Connolly. And that's, of course, where Community Radio Yall first started up there. But did you know, folks, and I didn't know this till the truth, but Thomas did an extensive history, a history dig on the actual premises itself, and he came up with some absolutely amazing results. We'd actually call it, I suppose, from black shirts to pirates. Good morning to you, Tom, indeed. You're very, very welcome, and thanks for dropping in.
Thanks, Noel. Thanks a million.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about this premises. Now, we're talking about, of course, I think it goes down as Knockaverry Farm, doesn't it?
It does, Noel.
And the title of it, actually, and the premises we're talking about, right alongside the golf links, the golf club.
Yeah, so Knockaverry Farm, the house would have been the farmhouse for the land that surrounded it. And it would have been owned probably in the early part of the 1900s by the Fleming family, from the Catalina May and yes. Fleming's Bakery, etc.
I think it was their house at once. And the entrance apparently was at Carltonville. It went up, what was, as we call it, Dr. Murphy's there, and right across the new road. That was the entrance, actually.
That was the entrance, because the new road wouldn't have existed. Goffling's yeah. Road, as we know today, like Rectory Road further down, we'll say up from Clancy's, those houses weren't built till 1890. So that road, the Goffling's Road as we know today, wouldn't have been constructed until sometime in the late 1800s. So the access would have been up opposite the lighthouse.
I think somebody had discovered a date on a rock when the new road was built. I think it was 1923 or 1924. I think, they exposed the rock, I think, actually, but there's a signature and a date on the rock, apparently, when the road was built.
Yes, because the road, Goffling's Road, would have come up as far as Rectory Road, and then Longville was probably built around the same time, 1890.
So it probably stopped at Longville, so I suppose, around that time, yeah.
So you would have had, as we know today, Dr. Murphy's coming up from the lighthouse.
Yes.
You would have had Poison Bush Lane.
Yes.
And that would have continued across the hill and down into Kilcorn.
Apparently it went down into Kilcorn, yeah. And I believe across the golf links, actually, on some days, I suppose, as the way the growth of the grass, you could still see the two little faint ridges on the grass all the way over along.
You can do alongside the ditch that still remains there.
Yes, there was a little path all the way along, yeah.
Yeah, up from the hockey pitch.
Yeah.
So I suppose when I was young, we'd heard this story. My father would have mentioned at one time that before my mother and father moved into the house after they got married in 1955. They married in February 55 and they moved to Knockaverry in September.
Mm.
And I remember as a young child, my father had mentioned, there was a black shirt lived in the house here before us.
And of course, a black shirt was one of Mussolini's gang.
Mussolini and Mosley and et cetera. And, you know, as a young kid, this guy, Captain Bud, was kind of, you know, when you're reading The Secret Seven and The Famous Five, you're like intrigued by who was this guy?
Yeah.
And, of course, forgot about, you know, we were doing history in school and learning about the black shirts, etc. And that's probably why it came up in conversation. And then forgot completely about it and went out of my head. But when COVID came and the first lockdown came,
you had a bit of time. We had a bit of time.
Yeah, we were doing all the painting and decorating and all the repairs and whatever. And in the evening, I just said, Captain Bud, I wonder, is there any truth to that story?
And of course, you're the occupant of the house now. Yourself and your family are the occupant of the house now.
Yes.
Yes.
So I started digging around on the internet and I found a Captain Charles Harry Bentinck Bud.
Right.
And this character was born in 1897 and he came from a well-to-do family. His great-grandfather was a major figure, I found out subsequently, a major figure in the London Stock Exchange.
Oh, yeah.
A man called Henry Budd, and he was a buddy of Charles Dickens.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So he died in 1842 and he left £200,000 at the time.
Which was a colossal amount of money.
Today that would be the equivalent of 28 million sterling.
That's, my goodness.
You know, 35 million euros.
Yes.
And one of the stipulations in his will was that none of the heirs could ever grow a moustache. If they did,
they would be written out of the way.
They would be written out of the way. So he was obviously a bit of a strange character.
Obviously,
and,
he was,
As I said, Captain Bud, as we know him, I was born in 1897. Now, his father, whatever he had inherited at that stage, I think he had nearly gone through.
Yes.
Bud's mother left because her husband and Bud's father, he was abusive. She took off to Australia, no more to be heard of. Bud, when the First World War started, he lied about his age and joined the army at 16.
Mm-hmm.
And he fought in the First World War. And at the Battle of Loo in 1915, he was seriously injured from 3 machine gun bullets. And he ended up with a silver plate in his head, and he was pensioned out of the army.
Yes.
Now, after the end of the First World War, he then went back to France because there was a kind of rebuilding project.
After the war, yeah.
He was in the Corps of Engineers doing the rebuilding. And, you know, it must have been around that time that the Russian Revolution was happening, and he did make an attempt. He opposed the revolution in Russia, and he did make an attempt to join the White Army in Russia.
In Russia,
but
yeah,
they wouldn't have him.
You were talking about maybe 1917, 18, around that time, yeah.
And but he couldn't join the Russian White Army because of his injuries.
Mm.
And like when you think of it today, like we can get in a plane in Dublin and be in Australia in 27 hours.
Yes.
But for a guy living in England to go, I'm going to go after Russia to fight, like, you know, it's just boggles the mind today.
Listen, even coming up to our standards, and going to Cork was a day, was an exhibition.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness, going to Cork like was a huge exhibition, like just planned for weeks beforehand, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, but
Bud, he tried a couple of things, then a couple of business things. He had a small industry pressing steel, and then he was importing flowers from Italy. And a couple of different things.
Yeah.
But it was in 1933 where the fascists started to rise because Hitler was coming up in Germany.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Mosley had started the Black Shirts in the UK.
Was he a socialist or a pacifist? Or what was his manner towards, world affairs?
Bud himself?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd say he was really a kind of establishment figure. I think he was kind of conflicted because, if you think about it, his family had money.
Yes.
But they weren't actually part of the establishment.
Yes, yeah.
They were like his great-grandfather who left all this money would have been like part of the Nouveau Riche in the
1800s. Yes.
But he wasn't sir this or sir that.
No, he wasn't a Bedeen crowd, like, you know. Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
So I think maybe in some respects, if you read through a lot of the stuff about Bud, that he had come from wealth and from a certain status, but he wasn't part of the establishment. And I think by being a fascist, he thought maybe he could gain some notoriety
he was
a difficult enough sort of character. So in 1933 he joined the fascists, and he was really, you know, he was really engaged with them. He met Oswald Mosley, who was the head of the fascists, the Black Shirts in the UK, and they became great buddies. And Bud became the administrator for Sussex for the British Fascist Party, and actually grew the membership. And he was, even though he was a kind of difficult character to deal with, he was quite vain and quite abrupt. He did attract people to the organisation.
Yes, but I get a picture basically of this of himself and the type of character he was. Yeah.
Yeah, and he subsequently stood for election, and he was elected as the first councillor in the UK as a member of the British Fascist Party.
Oh, yes.
So he was quite well up.
He was, yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, World War II came along, and Winston Churchill wanted to stop people who had been part of the British Fascists joining the army. Because if they got into the army, the fear would have been that these guys would have created sedition and created unrest in the army, and, you know, what side were they on?
Yes, Churchill regarded, I suppose, anyone that wasn't, true bulldog blood, Germany, Italy, as regards aliens.
Yes.
And I think he deported a lot of them to Canada. I think Canada took a lot of them at the time, you know?
Yeah, and there would have been a lot of you know, kind of anti-foreigner, yes, anti-alien feelings in the UK at the time.
Yes.
So Churchill introduced this Defence Regulation 18B, and I didn't know this until I was researching this, that there was 1,800 people interned. There was internment camps set up in the UK.
There was, yeah.
And they were actually arrested and imprisoned. No,
and some of them were just, they had businesses.
Oh, yes.
You know, like there were shoemakers, cobblers, tailors, you know, and just because we say they were of Italian descent or Axis descent, for want of a better word, yes, they were regarded as aliens.
Yeah, or if they had belonged to any fascist party or any party, yes, that opposed the British stance in the Second World War. So Budd was interned and he was released. He did challenge it and he was released for a couple of weeks, but he was rearrested and he ended up in Brixton Prison for,
right,
2 years.
Yeah.
Now, there's a thing I'll come back to in a minute, but it's very ironic that he ended up in Brixton Prison. So in 1944, then, he was released. 44, when the war looked like it was going to come to an end,
yes,
he was released. And after the war, he ended up, he had rented farmland, etc., and he was growing crops because, obviously, after the war, there was a food shortage. You had,
yes,
people returning from the war.
From
soldiers,
the war, yeah,
returning.
And, of course, you still had rationing. Even in this country, you still had rationing long after the war finished, yeah.
Exactly. Mm. So he was... had contracts with the British government.
Mm.
Now, even though he'd been released from internment, he was still under certain conditions after his release. So,
right,
for instance, he had to sign on once a week,
yes,
at the local police station. He had to inform the security services if he moved address. His post would have been intercepted and copied.
Mm.
Any phone calls would have been recorded. He would have been observed by the local police,
yes,
in whatever way,
yes,
whatever area he was living. And it was only after 44, 45 that he no longer had to sign on every week.
Yeah, but after the war. Yeah,
after the war had kind of come to an end.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was still under those conditions. Now, there's a bit of a gap because the first record I have of Budd coming to Ireland was his son's birth was recorded in Wexford in 1948.
So obviously, when he came from prison, a bit of a gap, and he actually came over here.
He did.
Yeah.
So he was probably, he was around the UK for maybe 2 or 3 years after the end of the war. But I'd say, like, there was a lot of anti-fascist feeling because Britain had won the war.
Yes.
Anybody who opposed it wouldn't have been that welcome.
Yeah.
Even though he was able to work and still make an income in the UK, maybe he felt he needed to
And
get
he
out
was
for
an all-round man by the looks of his what he turned his hand to, like.
Oh, yeah, he could. He seemed to, like,
yeah,
maybe because of his descendants, like his
yeah,
great-grandfather was a stockbroker, his father was in business, even
yeah,
though it doesn't look like he was very successful because
yeah,
he lost their fortune.
Yeah.
But he...
He came to Wexford anyway. He came to...
He came
yeah,
to Wexford,
yeah,
and then he must have come to Yall sometime around 48 or 49.
You'd wonder what brought him to Yall.
Well, that's the interesting thing because, like, I had no actual evidence
yes,
of him being in Yall or being in Knockavery until I got the MI5 files, which are in Kew Gardens.
Right.
And you can research them online because they've been released under the
30-year rule. Yeah.
And it was only when I got right down to the bottom. Like, I knew I had a Captain Budd. I knew he had been a fascist. I knew he had fought in the First World War. I had all this information, but I had actually nothing to connect him to Knockavery.
Right.
So it wasn't until down at the bottom of the MI5 files, and there's several hundred pages just on Budd alone, that I found two letters. So these letters, he would have written in Knockavery, they're Knockavery Farm, Yall, County Cork. He had written them to former buddies of his in the fascist party, one guy called Eagle Thompson, a real name. That's a great name.
Yeah, Eagle Thompson. Says a lot for the chap, doesn't
it?
Yeah.
MI5 would have intercepted these letters,
right,
copied them, and then put them into his file.
Yes.
So only for that, I'd have no definitive proof that he ever lived in
yeah,
Knockavery. But in those letters, he writes about, you know, he's running a poultry business above at the farm.
Yeah.
And so, like you said, he was an industrious sort of guy.
He was.
And he writes about another famous Yall character, called Claude Coburn.
Of course. And I wonder, was it the writings of Claude Coburn brought him to y'all, I wonder? It's hard to know.
I wouldn't think so. Well, the thing is, like, Claude was a communist.
Yes.
And Bud is a fascist. Like, Bud would have detested him. I don't know how Coburn would have felt. Claude would have felt about him.
I would imagine there'd be kind of a love-hate relationship there. Because obviously, if he came to y'all, he'd have, and if he ran a poultry business here, I would have imagined at the time, y'all was a small place, he would have got wind of Claude outside.
He knew Claude was town, and he says in the letters to Eagle Thompson, like, he speaks about Claude and that he was living in y'all and that Humphrey Bogart had been at his house, because Claude was well known around the world.
Oh, surely.
There was all sorts of people had...
The son ended up writing for the New York Tribune, I think.
That's is it? Alexander.
Yeah, is it?
Alexander. And Patrick Coburn writes for the Independent in the UK.
Yes.
And younger people today wouldn't remember them, but anybody who knows the actress Olivia Wilde.
Yes.
Olivia would be a granddaughter of Claude.
Of Claude, yes.
So... Bud is writing about Claude Coburn and, you know, giving out about him, because Claude was a character.
Of course, I think he coined the phrase at one stage, you know, and I suppose it really comes... In today's climate, we look upon it, and Claude once wrote, he said, "Y'all town," he says, "y'all stands at a slight angle to the rest of the universe." No, listeners, you can take it away, whatever way you want it, you know. But having said that, it is fascinating how Bud actually came to the farmhouse, because obviously the farmhouse must have been empty, and the farmhouse at the time, I suppose, was owned by, as you said, the Fleming family, and possibly May Fleming at the time. Would she have rented it out to this fella?
No, she would have rented it out. Yeah. But the only kind of idea I can come to is, like, how did this guy end up in Yall? He's in deepest West Sussex and suddenly he lands in Yall. And the only thing I can think of is, like, the Duke of Devonshire's wife, the father of the present Duke of Devonshire, he was married to one of the Mitford sisters.
Yes.
If people have ever heard of the three Mitford sisters. Yeah. One of the other Mitford sisters was married to Moseley, the head of the Black Shorts.
Yes.
And he had a connection with Fomoy.
Right.
So of course, perhaps, like, Bud and Moseley were still, although Bud had left the Fascist Party, they were still on friendly terms after the war, etc. Mm. So maybe Moseley had recommended y'all.
Possibly had, I suppose, because Moseley, I suppose, through Devonshire.
Yes.
Because Devonshire, as we all know, like, Devonshire had an affiliation with y'all down through the years. Yeah. And, of course, it was well known in British, in the upper echelons of British society, that y'all was, I suppose, the gateway to Blackwater years ago. So could have came from that connection.
Yeah, that's the only... That's
yeah,
the only,
could have came from that, you
that's
know.
The only conclusion.
And, of course, as well as that, then Flemings, I suppose, at the time, they had frigates going to Biddeford and Wales and the whole lot. Like, they had a close connection with the British, and indeed, I suppose, the British Empire as well, I suppose, at the time. So, look.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, we look at the internet and worldwide communications now as very fast and very quick.
Yes.
But actually, there was a level of communication then between countries on a one-to-one
of course
basis,
of
and
course.
Word of mouth, and et cetera. Yeah. So,
but mostly, anyway, he ended up, anyway, above in Knockaverry Farm.
Or Bud.
Bud
ended up above Knockaverry Farm, and he was running a poultry business there.
And how long was he there for?
He was there, I reckon, from 49 to about 53.
Yes.
And then this kind of, his MI5 file was closed in 1954, so he was obviously no longer deemed a threat to the...
He might have passed on, would he?
The British government. Yeah. No, he actually, he died in Eastbourne.
Oh yeah,
I found his death record in Eastbourne in the UK in April 1967.
Oh my God! Yeah,
now, he was quite a young man, but that might have been a consequence of his injuries at 70 years of age.
But so he went back so obviously after staying here for a number of years and went back to England again.
Yes, but there's something else I discovered since, because I mentioned earlier about Moseley being imprisoned in Brixton, or being interned in internment in Brixton Prison. Now, outside Brixton Prison, on the junction of Effra Road and Brixton Hill Road, and I know the exact place myself.
Yes,
there was a big cemetery there.
Right.
And in the late early 1950s, Southwark Council decided they want to create a park there for people's enjoyment. But what they had to do was they had to remove the remains that were in the graveyard and reinter them elsewhere.
Yeah.
And all the families of the persons buried there agreed, with the exception of our Captain Budd. Now, this was the grave of his great-grandfather.
Yes.
This thing was 30 tons in weight. It was essentially a mausoleum. Budd's father was also buried there. And Budd initially agreed to it happening.
But then he subsequently said
no. And actually, I found an interview that he did with the Weekly Dispatch in London in 1953.
Right.
Where he's described as Captain Budd, who was now retired and living at Knockaverry Farm, Yall. And he was interviewed as to why he had now subsequently,
refused permission for this mausoleum to be moved. Yeah.
And the amazing thing is that monument is still there today. It's
Go
at
away.
The junction of Ephra and Brixton Hill Road in London.
You'd imagine the council would have got a compulsory moving order and said, look, we're moving it, man.
Yeah,
but apparently that was part of a thing.
Apparently, and it's a huge monument.
It's a testament to him as well as the farm. Like.
Yeah, and I think part of that was perhaps because he was imprisoned in Brixton Prison and he could look out and see this monument and thought, I'm not letting you take that away from me.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's fascinating.
That was him, kind of anti-establishment, I suppose, flew in the face of normality, you could say.
It is, yeah.
It sounds to me like a character like that, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, it's
fascinating. Yeah, absolutely fascinating story.
Like, the internet's a wonderful thing when you go looking for stuff.
When you want to do research.
There's so much info, but the only problem is you can end up down an awful rabbit hole
You have to dissect it and you have to look at, I suppose, facts.
Yeah,
you know?
And the other issue is that because, like, I look back and I found the first mention I found of Knockaverry Farm as such was in 1766, because that's in the corporation notes from in the Annals of Yall.
Yes.
And it mentioned that there was a lease made to Osborne Great Rakes. That's some name.
He was Great Rakes, was Valentine Great Rakes, lived, I think, in... I remember John Young talking about Valentine Great Rakes. He was, I suppose, kind of a soothsayer, kind of a doctor at the time.
Well, yeah, he...
And this fellow, obviously with the name Great Rakes, this fellow must have been related to him.
Yeah, I think he might have been Osborne Great Rakes' great-grandfather. I've read about him. He was like a mystic physician.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. At the time when there was doctors, I suppose, were quacks. Sorry,
yeah.
Dr. Matthew, I was not talking about you. But doctors were basically quacks and bloodletting and all this kind of thing. He was one of these mystic chaps, I suppose.
He was. Yeah. But there was a lease made by Yall Council or Yall Corporation at the time in 1766 of the House Quarter and West Quarter of the lands at Knockaverry. So that's because, like, probably up until the railway came to Yall, once you moved outside of what we know as the main centre of town now within the town walls, there wasn't a whole lot out there.
No, because if you look at the Griffith's valuation of 1851, if you look at the map with that, actually, it just says Yall.
Yes.
Mudlands, Yall lands, Yall lands, end of story. Everything was outside, everything was Yall lands.
Yeah, you would knock a very extended from essentially the lighthouse and right across the hill. Yall lands was above that, we'll say where St. Raphael's is now, etc.
Yeah.
And because this land was under the control of the corporation, it wasn't owned by individuals, and Irish people couldn't own land. All this land was leased out.
Yeah.
By the council, and it wasn't until the railway came in 1860-ish that places began to develop, like the Front Strand as we know it today.
Of course, built by the British, I suppose, Army. They were army houses actually, but the retired army houses, I think.
Retired army houses.
Same as Longville, I think, was the same. Longville, I think, was the same thing. But I suppose getting back to the farmer, and getting back to Captain Budd. Captain Budd vacated the premises then. Must have been idle for a while before your parents took it over.
No, he left probably in 53, 54. 50. And I think Dick Curran and his wife, Dick Curran the butcher,
Oh, yes.
I think Dick lived there for... Lived there for a short while.
Yes.
Probably about the end of 54 and maybe just the start of 55. And then my mother and father moved in there in September 55.
And of course, they were the first... Your mother and father were the first people that actually bought out the premises.
Yes.
Yeah. Because before that, it should belong to the Fleming, May Flemings, we know. And of course, they let everything.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And back beyond that, it's very hard. Even if you look at the census of y'all from... 1910, 1901.
Yes.
Knockaverry is just on his house numbers. And that's it's odd. Very hard to identify who was actually living there at that time.
Yes.
And if you look back at the Griffiths valuation, the problem there is a lot of the transcribing, because the Griffiths valuation papers themselves are quite hard to read, a lot of the transcribing is wrong.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And if you look at the annals of y'all, and you're searching, I found a great site in the UK, in Harvard University, actually, the Annals of Law, y'all were donated there, a copy of them 100 years ago, I think.
Yes.
And you can actually search by word, but Knockaverry is spelt in a couple of different ways.
Yes. Knockaverry, 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 whatever the case may be. Because it goes from the old Irish, Knockverra.
Yes.
Mary's Hill. Yeah. And of course, we all know there was St. Anne's Monastery was up there for a while as well. So.
It was connected with the lighthouse.
You connected with the lighthouse.
With the previous lighthouse.
Yeah. But I suppose getting back to exactly the farmhouse itself, your father and mother were there then, of course, and they took it over then. And as I said, like, coming on to us, I suppose, this is where the pirates came in. From black shirts to pirates.
From black shirts to pirates in the radio.
In 1979, that's where Community Rail first started. Yeah. Little did we know at the time, and as we all know, it's well-documented fact, that when we, I suppose, went looking for a premises, everybody said no, but Eileen Conley said yes. And only for Eileen Conley, there'd be no radio here. We wouldn't be here talking, basically. We wouldn't be here talking because, in fairness, from very humble beginnings, the radio started off. And we owe so much to your family, and in particular to your father and mother. Because, as I say, Community Radio Y'all, and I hate banging on about it, but basically it's the envy of an awful lot of stations or awful lot of towns in and around the country. So, as I said, what a fascinating story, Thomas.
Yeah. And
absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, when you start digging around.
When you start digging around, and like, that is one house, I suppose, again, it was, I suppose, looking at it, to belong to the Fleming family, and the Fleming family... So they owned all the way up along, my God, up as far as Lynch's and up as far as St. Raphael's, literally. They had all the golf course land, and of course, bit by bit, you got rid of it, yes.
Yes, yeah. Over the years.
Over the years, you know.
But I suppose it was as the town developed that they started to sell off properties, and then I don't think there was really a huge number of descendants of Miss Fleming as we know her.
No. Well, I think, as I say, she ended up, I think, in the
Sacred Heart.
The Sacred Heart. Yeah, yes. That was the actual home place, I think.
Yes.
Originally, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, from merchants to black shirts and
pirates and merchants and black shirts. Yeah. Listen, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in, Thomas.
No problem.
Fascinating story, and it's a story, I suppose, that an awful lot of people here in Yard didn't know that it had connections to Mussolini and the black shirts and the Italians and the whole lot. Like, you know, and that's only one premises.
Yes, every house in this
every house could tell a story, I suppose.
You know, James Connolly was here and all sorts of people at one time were in Yall.
Yeah.
You know, and every house, I'd say, if you look back and you check the... Unfortunately, we lost a lot of records in Yall because of the fire in the forecourts.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
But unfortunately, there's still a lot of stuff there.
Yeah. Thomas Kelly, thank you very much for coming in. And indeed, I know we could go on for so long about it, but here you are. Listen, it's been fascinating having you in, and it's been a great, great story. And as I said, hopefully we'll see you in again when you'll do another little bit of research on that area up there. Because I'm always saying, at that particular area up there, up where we live, there's very, very little known about it. Exactly. You know, very, very little known about it, both the Golflings and St. Cordon's Abbey. You know, St. Anne's Lighthouse, all that, so much. So we'll have you in again.
Thanks, Lord.
Okay, thanks very much. That's Thomas Connolly. They're telling us a story, I suppose you could say, from black shirts to pirates, all about Knockaverry Farm, of course, and the house that, as I said, that Thomas grew up in, and then this we cut our teeth here in community radio all over. Go for that break, back directly after this.
Thanks a minute, no panic.
No.